Thank you for returning. So, the question was asked, if I do this intake like as complete as this, if a person is just coming for something like a sprained ankle, and the answer is you're going to get the kind of practice that you create, right? So if you don't like the way your practice looks, the only one you can blame would ever be yourself. And you have values. The way you practice is based on your values. And your values are going to dictate the outcome of what your practice looks like. So for me, when I take a patient on, my contract is as long as they meet the four criteria I told you about, that I will be able to treat them the rest of their life. And I feel it's my responsibility to be able to treat from before a person is born, meaning I'm treating their mother for infertility, their parents for infertility, and I should be able to treat from the time the person's born all the way up to when they die if they're 110 years old. And I should have a view, a clinical view, that encompasses an entire life and be able to take people as deep as possible. So when I treat people, I set up the expectation that I let them know of the depth I'm practicing at. And what's required is a two-hour session up front, cost $135, which is pretty freaking cheap, I think, for what they're getting. To get an hour, 2 hours of a physician's time would be $700, $500 to $700, right? So I want them to be committing the time, committing the resources. I let people know that for the follow-up treatments, they can pay me between $50 to $85, whatever they want, for each treatment. And that if they can't afford $50, they can just pay me whatever they can afford. So I never let money be in the way. And then when people come in, I let them know you're going to be coming either twice a week or once a week, depending how sick they are. And then as you start getting better, then you'll come either once a week or once every other week, and then once every other week, once every 2 weeks, once every 3 weeks, once a month. And then you'll come once a month the rest of your life for as long as you want to, for as long as you feel it's benefiting you. And I have some patients who I've treated literally for 30 years. And I have other patients I've treated for 30 years, but they come every 3 or 4 or 5 years, I'll hear from them, and we'll do 6 or 8 treatments, and then I won't hear from them for another 3 years. But I do a diagnosis this deep on everyone because I want the background information. So if they, even if that's the last time I see them for 14 years, I have a complete document of where they were at that moment. And if they come regularly for a year or 5 years or 10 years, I have a very strong basis to see where they've come from and where they are and what their status is, what the pulse was. When I do pulse diagnosis and I take 40 minutes, I'm doing a system with 9 different depths, 50 different places to put your finger, and I use about 50 different qualities on the pulse. And then I'm notating these. So the form that I'm filling out takes 40 minutes just to fill out every quality I'm feeling in every position. And there might be 6 qualities in a position, right? So then I can see where they are. So if I never see them again, but they come back in 4 years, I can go, oh, that psychoneurological pulse, or that pulse for ovarian cysts, or that pulse for the divorce, or the pulse for this or that is better, or it's worse, or it got more so. So I can compare. So I'm only interested in practicing deep medicine. I'm not interested in anything else. But patients will definitely come in for just 3 treatments and then say my back pain's better, and then I never hear from them again. But if anyone wants to see me, they have to go through this first session. I would feel ethically compromised if I didn't do that. And the only time I don't do it is if someone calls and they say, I'm just passing through town. They told me there's an acupuncturist. I'm only here overnight. I threw my back out. I get acupuncture in New York City or Montreal. I have a practitioner, but I'm away from home. Can you see me? And then I will, if I have an open slot in my schedule, I put the person in. And then I'll just talk to them for 15 minutes and as long as I'm convinced they're pretty cool, then I'll give them just a treatment. But this is not something that happens all the... This is a once a year, twice a year, something like that.
So your return patients, do you see them on the hour?
I have 3 treatment rooms, and I see someone at 8, 8:15, 8:30, 9, 9:15, 9:30. Do you see like that?
Yeah.
So I see 3 people an hour. About 15 to 20 people a day, 3 days a week. Generally, right now, 40 to 50 people a week. And in a few years, I'm going to treat less and just see really sick people and get to have just one person there at a time and spend my time taking notes and writing up cases and documenting everything. Okay. There. Any other question from before lunch? Okay. One of the things, so diagnosis, the time you spend in diagnosis isn't just diagnosis, it's also treatment. So what you are doing during diagnosis is you are establishing rapport. That should be a word that sounds like you should all know. So you're establishing rapport with the patient and you're setting up the entire context of the social contract, right? It's the entire ground of everything else that will come after. So that's why I think it needs to be so extensive. But you're also gaining the person's confidence and establishing a relationship with them. But diagnosis is treatment. So in the time I spend with a person, I am subtly manipulating them every moment. Do you understand? I am responding. Now, it's not that I'm thinking about all this, because it's past the point where I have to think about it. But the way I'm responding and the way I'm being with the person is all part of treatment. So, in general, I was taught by my teachers that before you put a needle in, the treatment should already be done. Before you put a needle in, the treatment's already done. And then the needle is reinforcing the treatment and it's opening the gates. So when patients tell me how much I'm helping them, I always tell them, I always respond when they say, you're doing so much for me. I always put it right back in their lap and say, no, you wanted to go in a direction and I'm just oiling the gates so you can go. I want them to take all the responsibility for it, you see. Because if they put all the good stuff on you, when stuff is bad, they will put that on you too. Right? So they have to be free, you have to be free. And I want patients to understand it's the effort they're making. I have a woman who has dropped in the last 6 months from a size 18 to a size 12. So that's pretty significant. And I told her the first day she came in, okay, I want you to spend $1,400 and get an elliptical machine. Here's the name of the company to buy the elliptical machine from. And I want you to stop eating dairy and rice, pasta, potatoes, and bread. And she said, okay, and she bought an elliptical machine. At first she could only do 2 minutes, but now she can do 40 minutes. And she's down from 225 to into the mid-160s, something like that. But she's the one doing it. It's not the acupuncture doing this. Do you understand? Acupuncture can't do that. She came with a goal, and I'm just giving her an organizing framework to do it. And then the acupuncture just reinforces and helps get the stagnation out of the body and move everything so everything works better. And so she feels better, you see? But it's her own effort, it's her own will, so that's very important. In terms of diagnosis in the five element tradition, we have something called testing emotions. So the way we diagnose in five element system is we look at the color around a person's face, we listen to the sound in their voice, we smell their odor, and we assess what their main emotion is. And this will tell us which of the five elements the person is. And we test emotion. Calling it testing emotions is really something that we use to just teach beginners how to do it. But it's not something, once you get to a point of actually understanding and having a competence to do it, it's not a deliberate thing anymore. You're just noticing what you're giving and what the person's interacting with. And it all sort of becomes pre-aware. It's sort of like when you play music and you learn how to use different scales. For a long time, you have to think, okay, the bass player is playing a dominant seventh, the piano player is playing a dominant seventh chord, so I'm going to use the Mixolydian mode to play over it. Do you understand? So you see the chord played, you hear a major tonality, and then you use the Mixolydian mode, or you hear minor tonality, and you use like a harmonic minor scale. And you're thinking to yourself, oh, they're doing this, but after a while, it's just all natural, and you're not thinking about it at all. And that's sort of the goal. So each of the elements has a pathological emotion. So for water, it's fear. For wood, it's anger. You all know this. For fire, it's joy or sorrow. For earth, it's worry, excessive worry. And for metal, it's grief and longing. So you can, the person's five-element constitutional element is going to be the one they get stuck in all the time. And you can test emotions, you can test fear. The person who's fearful all the time is always, when a person has fear, they're always asking for reassurance. So you can give reassurance. If the person's not water, the reassurance will calm them down and they'll just move on. But if they are water, once you give reassurance, they keep wanting more and more and more reassurance. And it's like a drug, and there's no amount of reassurance that's going to calm their anxiety. For wood, what the person's asking for is perspective. So you give perspective, and if they're not wood, the perspective will be useful. But if they are wood, they'll ask for perspective, but let them fight with the perspective you gave them. Or they'll just keep asking you for more. Oh, really? Well, what do you think about this? Because they're codependent. So now they're asking you for what do you think I should do? Should I leave my husband? Do you think I should quit my job? Then they start asking for perspective on everything. Fire wants connection. So when you offer connection to fire, they either reject connection because they don't want intimacy, or the connection becomes inappropriate and they want more. They mistake the connection you give them, and they want more and more and more connection from you. Do you see? With earth, the person is worried, and they really want nourishment. They want ground under their feet. You see? They want sympathy. They're worried, and they want sympathy. And you give them sympathy, and they're like a diabetic. They can't take it in. Like they can't take in sugar. They can't process it. Or they just want more and more and more sympathy. Oh, and let me tell you what happened to this person and that person. Let me tell you what happened. This person did this to me and that person did that. You see? It's just like they can't have just one cookie. They have to eat the entire plate. And then metal wants to be valued. So what metal is calling for is respect, or you could say acknowledgement. Affirmation would be another way to put it. And when you give affirmation to metal, they will either cut off from it, deny the affirmation, or they will want more and more and more affirmation, because what you are seeing is pride. Metal is proud. So we call that testing emotions. Again, it's something you can, when you think a person's a certain element, you can deliberately give the wood constitutional type perspective and see if they angrily reject it or if they dysfunctionally want more and more. You can give reassurance, you can give sympathy, you can give acknowledgement, you can give connection, or you can break connection and see how the person responds, you see? So at first when you're beginning it will be deliberate. But over time, just like a musician, you can just flow with it. And you don't have to think, what are the chords? What is the key? What tempo are we playing? You're just in something and it's alive and you're just going with it. Right? You understand? Okay, so I think we've covered everything on this first sheet. So if the board asks, you can tell them, you can say, yes, he did it. So now what I want to do is I want to go through with you the entire diagnosis, the entire process of diagnosis. You don't have to take too much notes on it. You have this. I sent it to Mona, and she was very nice to type it up and format it. Yeah. Well, you may take some notes. You know, whatever you think you want to elaborate for yourself. But anyway, so we're going to go through the whole diagnosis from listening to the person's voice on the answering machine to everything that happens in the office to everything that happens when they leave, when they're walking away from the office. Okay? A lot of this won't be different from what you learned, because there's only so much you can ask, but the perspective on it's probably going to be different, right? So slightly different perspective. So as I said before, I don't believe in using the questionnaires, these like 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 page questionnaires where a person's checking everything off. It's just too mechanical, it's too clinical, it's too impersonal. The information on the sheets, I'd rather get in person from the person, because what's more important to me than the actual data in the answers is how the person's relating to the data. You can ask a person, how are your bowel movements? And a person can say, fine, or fine, or fine, or fine. Those are, to me, those are 4 different answers, right? You're not going to get that on that form. And if you just hear fine and write down fine, what does the person even think? Fine might mean I have 2 bowel movements a week. Fine might mean I have 14 a day. So I want to see not just the information a person's giving me, but how do they relate to it? The 5 elements can all be thought of value systems that a person brings to their experience constitutionally. What that means is if you have 5 people in a room who are the 5 different constitutions, and they all have the exact same experience, the water constitutional type is going to relate to it in terms of fear and potential and excessively spending or hoarding resources. But the exact same experience to the wood constitutional type will be related as injustice and the dysfunctional relationship to making irrational decisions or refusing to make a decision when they should. And the fire constitutional type will relate to it in terms of intimacy and betrayal and needing to make a connection or break a connection. The earth constitutional type is going to relate to it in terms of abundance and being enough and being nurtured or not being nurtured, and then relate to it as dysfunctionally denying help or dysfunctionally asking to be taken care of. And the metal constitutional type is going to relate to it through either pride or shame, being special in some way, and of having lost value and needing acknowledgement or denying recognition. Do you understand? They're value spheres. They're value spheres. So it's not just the data the person's giving us, it's how they relate to the data. And the person's constitutional type is like a window that the person is looking at the world through that has a tint on it, and everything they are seeing is colored by that tint, and they don't know it because it was there from the moment their father's sperm hit their mother's egg. Literally programmed genetically into the template in a way that completely conditions consciousness. so that it's genetically in the single cell. When that human being was just one cell, the quality of chi in that cell was being determined by that imprint. And it was present in protein conformations and magnetic resonances throughout the cell. Do you see? It was there even when there was one cell. And then as they grow through life, it's always there, but they don't know it's there. And so in relationship to their life experience, they're drawing conclusions about the meaning of what's happening in relationship to themselves in a way that's completely mechanically programmed. And they just think it's all, they don't understand. They think it's this. So they draw conclusions about this is how I am. This is, something happened and this is what it meant. This is what it means about me. This is what it means about life. This is mean what it means about other people. This is what it means ultimately about God, whether they're thinking about it as God or just the ultimate nature of things. This is how things are. You see, this is just how things are. But the entire direction and quality of how they made that determination is determined at the moment of conception genetically. It's imprinted genetically and then reinforced by the culture they're born into, which is the culture of their family that gave them that genetic imprint in the first place, and then is acting out of those behaviors unconsciously themselves, reinforcing that very point of view. Do you see? And reinforcing that very point of view. Men and women have 150,000 years of genetic conditioning on the planet as human beings, and then culture, unconscious culture, reinforces that conditioning in all the advertising and movies and books and TV shows. Do you understand? So that's what we're all trying to break out of. If you're trying to break out of it, that is what there is. That's the matrix, in other words, right? That's that sort of like clamshell-shaped pod that you're stuck in and all the tubes are going into you. So one source is genetics and the other source is culture. And then there's consciousness, which is basically free. And from the Taoist and Buddhist perspective, the practice of medicine is to liberate consciousness from these two sources so that it can wake up to itself as self. So that's creating a very big spiritual context for understanding the practice of medicine, at least in the way I understand it, right? It's not in your job description, and you weren't tested on it in licensing exams. But anyway, that's what I'm teaching and doing. At least that's the context that I hold life in general. So I don't have a secretary. One reason I don't have a secretary is they have to eat, so you have to pay them. And I actually manage a clinic with 3 treatment rooms, seeing 40 to 50 patients a week, and I return all the phone calls myself. But the other thing is I never wanted anyone to be there mediating between me and my patients. So that means I use an answering machine. So my diagnosis starts when I get the phone call off the answering machine. In order to do diagnosis, you have to understand the context of the situation. So the context of the situation is I'm a medical practitioner who's serious about practicing medicine. I've studied my whole life to be able to offer help to people who can't find help anywhere else because of the kind of biomedical culture that we have, right? So a very significant percentage of our patients have tried drugs, they've tried surgeries, they've even gone to chiropractors and this and that, and they didn't get help. So they're coming to me because they think I can give them help. And that context to me would dictate that a thoughtful person, when leaving a phone message, making first contact with someone they're going to pay money and take time to, presumably because they have some confidence you can help them, you would think it was reasonable the person would have thought out what they're going to say, know why they were coming, have created a space to make a phone call in the context of being relatively undisturbed, in a quiet background, and be able to communicate effectively. what it is they're coming for. Does that make sense? Okay, so if you get a call, I've gotten phone calls like, "Hello, Lonnie, this is Jonathan. Please give me a call. I'd like to start treatment." So should I go through the phone book and call every Jonathan, starting in the A section and go all the way to Z? And then when, if they're not in Massachusetts, should I go to New York State? But people do this. I have people who call. This is real. My answering machine says, you've reached the acupuncture office of Lonnie Jarrett. I'm in the office Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and I return calls on those days. Leave your name, message, and number, and I'll be sure to call you back. That's easy enough. I'll come in on a Tuesday morning and I'll hear, "Mr. Jarrett, this is Mr. Jones. I'm in Massachusetts for the weekend. It's Thursday evening. Please call me back. I'd like to come in at 9 Friday morning for a treatment." Beep. "Hello, Mr. Jarrett. It's Mr. Jones. It's 12 o'clock on Friday. I left you a message yesterday. You didn't return my call." Right? "Hello, Mr. Jarrett. It's Saturday morning. I'm hoping you're in today." And by the time I come in Tuesday, after 6 calls, this happened once, I said, "Mr. Jarrett, clearly you have no idea how to conduct a business. Next time I'm in Massachusetts, and I need medical care, I'll call someone else who takes their business more seriously." Now, the man has just heard a message 7 times that says, "I'm in the office Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday." Right? "Please leave your name, message, number, and I'll call you as soon as I get in on Tuesday morning." How easy is that? He's heard it 7 times, but he's outraged and screaming. His diagnosis, beside just belligerent fool, is probably wood, belligerence, and small intestine, not listening. He's just not listening. Small intestine 19, listening palace. You see? So given the context, you want to see how well can a person articulate what they want, why they're coming, what their intention is for coming. You can hear over the phone the sound in their voice, so you can already do 5-element diagnosis, because you can hear if it's groaning, or if it's shouting, or if it's laughing, or You can hear if they're leaving a message like this, then it's singing. And you can hear if this is "Mr. Jarrett, this is Betty. I'm stuck in the abyss. Things are so lonely down here and so desperate." Do you see? Then you can hear metal, then you can hear weeping. So you can hear all the tones in the voice. And you can also get the person's emotion. Right? So you can hear sound and you can get emotion, which are two of the, obviously you can't do odor or see color. And then you can also pay attention to, people leave messages while they're listening to heavy metal music blaring in the background. So what kind of thoughtful person would contact a medical professional to convey, they would have to be very casual, really not paying attention at all to their environment, and very casual about any reason they had for coming for treatment, right? Or some people call, and in the middle, a woman will call in the middle and say, "God damn it, Bobby, get away from your sister!" Well, and then you get, all of a sudden you seem deeply into the home life, do you see? And how they're raising their children, which is very poorly, which means they're extending very poor care. What the mother just expressed to me is she's a victim of the children, she's not the one in control, she's not paying proper attention to the kids. So that would be a shadow projection of how she was raised and what her values are. Do you understand? My kids will raise themselves. Or I'm a big victim, nobody ever listens to me. Which is a shadow projection because she's not listening to her own heart and standing up for the conviction she has there. You can get everything in a... So one of the principles of diagnosis is all of who a patient is present in every part of themselves, every moment. Every sign you are seeing, everything they are doing, everything they are saying, everything that's happening is telling you the whole diagnosis, all the time. Now, that doesn't mean we don't get confused or that we see it. We have the eyes to see it all the time, but it's never not there. It's never not there. It's always there in everything all the time. So I begin talking to the person, and I say, you know, hello, Lonnie Jarrett here, and they begin talking, and I go, oh, I say, fantastic, great to hear from you. What are you coming for? And they'll tell me. And I'll say, okay, I can. So I see new patients Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 10 o'clock. I only do 10 o'clock. For the most part, 99% of the time. Because for me, 10 o'clock, I'm wide awake. I get into clinic in the morning, 8 o'clock. I treat patients 8 to 10. And then 10 o'clock, I like to have a patient for an hour and a half to two where they're the only ones there. But I'm wide awake. I don't want to spend 2 hours doing a diagnosis like this, 4 or 5 in the afternoon after working from 8 o'clock in the morning, because the only thing I'm thinking about is dinner or seeing my family at that point. But 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm wide awake, so I tell people 10 o'clock. And for some, most people, that's fine, but some will say, I can only do so-and-so. So if they can, I can't do that, I'm at work, I work till 4. And I really can't get out of work. And I ascertain why. And if they're really in an economic situation where they can't, and they really can't, I'll be flexible and I'll just say, okay, but we have to schedule this 3 weeks from now. Because I only leave those 10 o'clock time slots open for new patients. But if I think the person's just being inflexible, I'll try to force them into a 10 o'clock slot. And the average person with a healthy liver will accommodate. But if not, if they start getting belligerent, then, you know, then you're getting your diagnosis, right? Or if they're starting to act like a real victim. Are they making connection? Are they baking connection? Are they trying to seduce me? Do they start complaining, which would be a very earth thing to do, to try to get sympathy about why they can't come? You see, do they just feel isolated and cut off because I will only see them at 10? We have to see how are they relating. The Constitution will be the theme of how they unconsciously relate to everything. It's a theme of how they're imparting meaning to everything that happens all the time, at all times, in all places, and through all circumstances. How they're unconsciously thrown by genetics and karma to impart meaning to their life circumstance. So we'll make an appointment, and you know, the wood constitutional type will be the one who says, okay, I can come Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock. No, wait a second. Wednesday, my kids have a day off from school. I can come Tuesday at 5. No, I can't come. And you go make 7 different appointments. And then at the end, they go, wait a second. School meetings aren't this Wednesday. I can come at 10. So see, they can't organize data at all. They're confused. They can't put data in a hierarchical perspective, which is the liver's job, is to put data in a hierarchical perspective between water and fire, right? Liver's about hierarchy. The military, right? Martial arts class. The white belts go there. The black belts go there. Everyone line up by rank. That's why the liver has 500 enzymatic reactions. All the other organs do one thing, right? They do one or two things. The liver does 500 different things. It's all about what has to happen now, what has to happen now, what has to happen now. So we make an appointment. I want to know, does the person show up on time to their appointment? If some people come 30 minutes early, that's wood, right? Or fire. Knowing that they're always out of control, so they need to be in control. Or would, just like, I have to come half an hour early because if I don't, I'll feel so much pressure about getting to the appointment. Or just chronically being late. And if a person's late to their first appointment, I want to know why and see how much victimization they have in relationship to it. And there's no reason in the world to be late to an appointment, right? Not more than a minute late, if you're prioritizing it, if it's important to you. I mean, there are some good reasons, like my car exploded, or a tree was down across the road, or, you know, I came on a bus full of school children that had turned upside down, and then I'm going to be cool. But most people, you know, if a person is late and it's because they're casual, then you have to note that. And why are they casual? Whatever they're casual, whatever reason they're casual for, means that you've got hard to work and they're not taking it seriously. Now, the part of them that called and found out about you, took the time to find out about you, inquire, make the phone call, make the appointment, that's the part of them that cares about its reasons for coming. And the part that was so casual it was 15 minutes late for a first appointment is the part of themselves that doesn't care. Do you understand? So the person's walking down the alley on the way to the office, and I'm looking at them secretly through a window because I want to see how is the person when they don't know they're being watched compared to how the person is when they do know they're being watched. And the two very dramatic, distinct possibilities, which are not exaggerations, you can see this, are that when they're not being watched, they're walking very confident, but as they come up the stairs to the office, they like bend over and go slower and slower because they want your sympathy and your attention. Or they're bent over in the alley, but as they walk upstairs, they get straighter and straighter because they don't need anything from anybody. Do you see what I mean? I'm cool. I've got everything handled. So the person comes up to the office, and I always time it so I can always greet every new patient. Okay? I always, 99% of the time, I have it so I'm done with all my other patients. I try to never have a patient there when I'm doing an intake, so all my focus can just be on the one patient. So the last patient's left. They come up the stairs and I'm there to greet them. And now I've got color, sound, odor, and emotion because they're right there in front of me. And I walk over and I shake their hands. And in shaking their hands, I go like this. How are you? And I can tell the differential of temperature between her hands and her arm. If the arm is warmer and the hand is colder than her counterflow leather chick. If the arm is cooler and the hand is hotter, then that indicates the need for a heart aid, pericardium aid. I'm looking for the quality of connection, and then when I let go, so some people have handshakes like this. No chi, no blood. It's like, okay, but that's no chi and no blood, right? And all the chi, all the fire, if they do have fire, it's withdrawn into the interior, and they're basically saying, nothing's going to happen, touch me. You see? Nothing's going to get to me. No, you're putting pericardium aid and heart aid, this fire points together, and they're withdrawn all day. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going to touch me. Mm-hmm. We have no connection, you see? And the other is, you go to let go. You see, the other is being clinging. So being fire in the I Ching is the clinging. So fire clings to things. And metal doesn't let go. Metal doesn't let go, right? Okay. I'm also looking at the quality of eye contact, how much brightness there is, how much directness. The person has walked up, I'm looking at how they're dressed. Where are the tattoos? Are the scars I can see? What are the religious symbols? Are they dressed appropriately to the weather and to the season? Are they dressed appropriately and clean enough as appropriate for a medical appointment? What shades of color are they wearing? What are the color on the exterior versus the interior? So the jacket might be black, but then they take it off and they have bright red underneath. So on the outside, they're showing one thing, but on the inside, and you can also compare that later to the color of the underwear, which is like the deepest, most private thing, right? And then I say, I would like you to hang your jacket up here in the hallway. And how are they with that? I've just taken control. I'm asking them to trust me. Sometimes people will say, will it be safe? And I always make the joke, I always say, no, the jacket thief of Stockbridge is going to come and take your jacket. Is it going to be safe? No, I'm going to rifle through your pockets as soon as I get the opportunity. So you have to see how much trust they have. And I also say, I'd like you to take your shoes off at the door. Which, for our generation, isn't that just natural? None of you would think of that, would you? Like, if I said, take your shoes off, leave them in the hall, you'd just be fine. But some people get very uptight over it. Like, that's a really weird thing. But it's my office. For me, it's nothing esoteric. It's just that if you have 50, 60 people a week in the kind of weather we get, traipsing through your office 7 months a year, you're going to destroy the carpets. So I just have people take their shoes off in the hall. That's simple enough. Again, are they resentful about it, which would be wood? Do they want to take control and say, I don't feel comfortable with that? You see? And then we go into the office and I say, would you like to use the bathroom? And if they say no, I note to myself, how long after I ask that during the diagnosis do they say, actually, I need to go to the bathroom? And that just tells me they were embarrassed to go to the bathroom when I said it. Do you see? They were being proud in some way. Because we sat down and 6 minutes later they said, actually, I have to go to the bathroom. Then I know that maybe they're not that in touch with their reserves, not that in touch with how they're feeling or where they're at. So you have to discern what that is. We walk into the room and I say, please have the chair on the left. Some people will just walk to the chair on the right and sit down. Even though I said, please have a seat, they're taking control or they're not listening or both. Some people will say, why do I have to sit in the chair on the left? That means they think they're entitled to know. Do you see? They're very rational. They're hyper-rational. They want data. They want a rational explanation for everything. They're really in the mind. They don't have the trust to just follow directions and surrender a little bit, which is very much a fire kind of control thing. The reason they sit in the chair on the left is the window in the office is on the right, and I want the natural light to come and fall on their face rather the other way around than the light's falling on their back and they can see me but I can't see them. So then they sit down and,
I'm just curious, when you said, when you tell them to which chair to go to and if they don't, it's either they take control or they don't listen or both.
Dyslexic.
But I don't
could
understand.
Be dyslexia.
Okay. But can you want to control and not listen?
Yes, if you're adamant that you're the one who has to be in control, what's the point of listening?
If you know, do whatever you want or
yeah, exactly. There's nothing to listen to because I'm the one in control.
Okay, I understand.
The king doesn't have to be a good the only one the king has to listen to is the general. Do you see? But the king in general doesn't have to listen because he's the one who gets to tell everyone what to do. He doesn't have to listen to others. And the virtue of the heart is the small intestine, the highest virtue is listening. And the small intestine is the official closest to the heart, the organ closest to the heart. So then we've sat down and I have the diagnosis divided into three sections. The first section of the diagnosis, I'm getting background and asking people about their family history, their job, their relationships, their hobbies, all stuff that on the outside is not really challenging to an individual because they think that you're asking about other people. But actually, what you're asking about is the very foundation. You're asking about their mother, their father, their sister, their brother, that's their birth family. You're asking about their genetics, but you're also looking at their relationship to all these people. And it's those foundational relationships in life that have set the template for their entire life in terms of cultural conditioning when they were very young, before they even had language. These are the primal conditioning prior to language that they got. So actually, the person won't be much on guard when you're asking these questions because they think you're just saying, you know, how's your mom's health? How's your dad's health? Do you have brothers or sisters? Are you married? How's your kid? So they think you're talking about everyone else. But the main predictors of health and happiness in life are how good is the quality of your relationship to your birth family How good is the quality of your relationship to the family you've created? And what's your job satisfaction? In other words, to what degree does your job give you an opportunity in life to use your skills and talents? Okay, so the person comes in, they sit down. I always say, it's very nice to meet you. And has anybody referred you to me? First of all, I want to know who the source of referral is for several reasons. Well, one, I'm making... See, this is all very devious. When they tell me the name of the... Since I don't advertise, it's all word of mouth. That's all it's ever been. So it has to be word of mouth. I do have my name in the phone book, and once or twice a year I get a patient who looks me up on the phone book or the internet. But most of the time it's word of mouth. So as soon as they tell me the person who referred them to me, some interesting things have happened. One, I've established a mutual connection with somebody they trust. Do you see? At the very foundation of the outset, what I've done is established you're coming because you trusted that person, and that person had enough confidence in me to recommend you, and I'm reinforcing that sentiment. Secondly, I get to assess who is the person who referred them, and to the degree I know that person well, it's going to give me information about who they are. Oh, that person thought you could use help. Do you see? And it tells me something about the karmic connection between us now, because I know what my karma is with that person, what my history is with that person. I've asked that, and this has established an unconscious but deep basis of relationship at the very outset. It's pretty devious, isn't it? Right, don't you think? In a good way. Well, we talk about all we do when you treat is you manipulate chi. All of treatment is manipulation. It's nothing wrong with manipulating people as long as you're doing it for their own good. Right? You should answer Harry's Pizza. Yeah. Okay. So, they're going to call every 4 minutes. Well, if they call again, you can answer and tell them we're closed for the day.
But three is a pattern.
Right. Well, what they think is going on is they think the place is just full and that whoever's supposed to answer the phone is just too busy.
Okay.
Something like that.
Right,
no, well, just if they call again. You don't have to stand by the phone, Mona. So then I ask the person, I say, what is your full name? Now, they've told me their name on the phone. So you don't want to say, what is your name? Because then they'll think you weren't paying attention. But most people won't have told you their middle name. So you can say, what is your full name? When they answer what their full name is, you want to imagine who it is that's speaking. Right? So the way you became yourself, okay, so the very first act in this world, well, she does. She just doesn't know it. Well, what's your name?
Oh, what's my name?
Your whole name.
Sorry,
what's your whole name?
Marie-André Saint-Pierre.
Marie-André Saint-Pierre. Just ask full name. Just ask people.
That's my
I know.
First name.
I understand.
Okay.
I was joking. Okay. So anyway, you say what's your full name because you want to hear them say their name. So you can just say full name. And you want to see, so is it the grandmother that loved them that's saying it? Is it the father who was hypercritical? Do you see what, is it the some... Is it the Nazi torturer in their head? Is it some benevolent person who helped them in the past? Then your name in Taoism is the first act in the world of separating you from original nature is cutting the umbilicus. And then the second act is giving you your name. So Lao Tzu says the way that can be named is not the eternal way. In Taoism, it's the giving of name that causes things to forget their original nature. Oh, I'm Lonnie. I'm not the universe. I'm Lonnie. So when you hear people say their name, you want to listen. Is there compassion in the voice? Is there judgment in the voice? Is it hurried? Is it slow? Did the voice get deeper? See, the personal name is very deep. The personal name is what defines the ego. It's very, so there's a lot in that. So I ask them their name, and I say, where did you grow up? And that gives them the opportunity to say, you know, I moved all over, or I never grew up, and to giggle, something like that, to be casual. And I say, do you still have family there? Do you still have family there? And they might say, well, my mother lives there, which means either my father's dead or my parents were divorced. But you didn't have to ask that. Do you see? They might say, well, my father still lives there. Well, my father still lives there. Those are two totally different answers, you see? In one, there's antipathy, and in the other, there was warmth, emotional warmth. I asked a person, how old are you? And then that will give a whole range of possible answers. Women in the generation in this room don't care about giving their age. But women in previous generations, when I was younger, 30 years ago, all the women over 40 wouldn't tell you how old they were. Almost all of them. Let's say 70% would say, I don't tell my age. Do you see? Or they'd say, I'm 30. As kind of a joke. Or old enough to know. They'd make some kind of joke because they were very uncomfortable. But in this generation, that isn't a thing at all. In this generation, the expectation is you're going to be sexy and juicy and having great sex till you're 90. At least that's what the culture is selling, right? That's the product the culture is selling. It's a very different value system than women who will be like 70 or older now. They were raised in a very, very different culture. So I say, what is your age? And some people will say things like, oh, you know, 41, maybe 42. I don't pay attention to things like that. So that's kind of like, okay, is that really true or is that pretense? Do you see? Is that really true or is that pretense? What they're trying to say is, I'm open-minded and I have no age. Well, really? Well, let's see if that's true. Or if it's just the thought or a kind of pretense that you're giving. And then I say, what's your date of birth? And there's a big difference between 42158 and 42158. Everyone should be able to say 60 July 5th, 1942 or whatever. That would have been true in 2002. Okay? But everyone should be able to go boom, boo doo doo doo. What you're testing there is how quick can the Shen access the Jing? How quick can the heart access the kidney? How quick can the mind access data? And some people say 43, no, 44. For some, that will be a pretense, but for some, actually, there's a breakdown of communication between Jing and Shen, because that data should be right there at the tip of the tongue. They should have instant access to it. Okay, so then I say, you know, ask about where did you grow up? Is your family still there? Look at the quality of answer. All the time I'm right. I take notes on computer now, actually, so I'm typing it. And then, now, are your parents alive? And if they say yes, I say, how old is your father? And the answer could be, my father's 72. That means they have a relationship to their father. Even if they haven't seen him in 50 years, it means they have a relationship. Do you see? They know. Or they might say early 70s, which means even if they think they're close, they're not that close. The thought of being close is more a self-image issue than actually being close, because if you were close, you would know exactly the name. I mean, you would know exactly how at the date, how old they were. And then I ask, how is your father's health? And then you may get an answer like, oh, it's fine. He had brain cancer 2 years ago, but it's better now. So that can mean two different things. It can mean the person's so close to their father that they have such a deep investment in him being well that they can't imagine life without him, so they're in total denial of what it meant to have brain cancer. Or it can mean that they have such a poor relationship with the father, that they have such a casual relationship, that they're not really paying attention or interested. You see? So how's your father's health? And by health, I want to know, has he had any surgery in his life? And is he on any medication for chronic conditions? Because that's giving me information about genetic basis that I may need to be concerned with. If the father is dead, I want to know what chronic conditions did he have during his life and what did he die of? Because both those things will also tell me about genetic basis. And then for the mother, the same thing. How old is your mother? What conditions does she have? And in the way the person's talking about, when they talk about father and mother, they're talking about their relationship to their own Jing Chen and Shen and Yuanxi. You understand? Because that's the source. Father and mother were the karmic source of yin and yang for them. So you're talking about their root level relationship to the people who incarnated them. And you're looking for the quality. Did they sink down in the chair? Did they make eye contact? Did they break eye contact? What's the emotion that came through? If there was alcoholism, physical, emotional, sexual abuse of any sort whatsoever, it will come through when a person is talking about the perpetrator, regardless of how mundane the level of discussion is. All the information will be there in their countenance of how they're relating to the person. Then I want to know if they have siblings, brothers and sisters, what's the ages, because I want to know where they fall relative in age. Where they fall relative in age is important for several reasons. The closer you are to the top of the hierarchy, meaning older, God damn it, we're closed. So the old, the close. She shouldn't have said that.
Oh, right.
No TV on the wall. So, Mona, you shouldn't tell them.
I turned it down, but it can't go off.
Yeah, but don't tell people they're away till the 11th.
Well, yeah, no, this woman comes a lot.
Oh, okay, but.
She goes, I'm here every Sunday, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, but anyway.
Thank you. It's written on the door, Lon.
Oh, okay. Good enough.
Is that your friend?
Okay. So moving on, where were we? You asked me a question. You have a question.
What do you mean by karmic source of yin and yang?
Do you know what karma is?
Yeah.
How do you think about karma? What do you, when you said you know what karma is, Well, your karma comes through your lineage. Part of karma is your lineage. You know, who your parents are is part of your karma when you incarnate, right?
What I know about karma is more you do something good.
That's not how karma works.
Okay, that's what I want to
talk about. No, because some people do very good and they get shot with bullets. And some people do very bad and live a long time. Karma has more to do with how much virtue you cultivate in your life for the sake of virtue itself. So good karma just means you lived with dignity. It doesn't assure any kind of positive outcome. But it's not just from this life. It would be in terms of all your past lives, if there are past lives. So, in other words, it's your karma that you got these parents in your life. Do you see? It's not random. According to Buddhist and Hindu ways of thinking, it wouldn't be random. Okay, so what were we talking about? Yes, so, okay, so if you're born first, your parents were younger and you tend to get more jing. And if you're born more toward last, so if they're just two kids, no problem, unless your parents started when they were 35 or 40. But if there are five or six kids, the younger you are, the less jing you got. Because they just were older. So that's important to know as the birth order. And then you want to see how the person is relative to talking about each individual. Even if it's just Bobby is 16 and Chester is 22 and Molly is 32 and Peggy, she's 50. See? Go, oh, what happened there? That's interesting. Tell me a little more about Peggy. Do you see? Because there was a difference. So you're always looking for what's the difference? What's the difference? Where's the thing that stands out? So you go through siblings, and then you ask, are you in a relationship? So the parents and the siblings, they didn't get to choose. But the relationship they get to choose, but most people will choose a relationship based on their genetics and the karma they had with their birth family, right? Like women tend to marry their fathers and boys tend to marry their mothers. It's just sad but true. It's just a tendency. Just a tendency. So are you in a relationship? And if the person says yes, they might say yes. They might say yes. I'd say yes. They might say yes. No. Yes, maybe. You go, what do you mean by relationship? Well, these are all answers you get. What do you mean by relationship? And I would just say, what do you mean by relationship? What does relationship mean to you? You could say, are you in relationship? A person could say, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Then I want to know what that means. If they say I'm in relationship, I say, how is it? And then I listen. And they might say, good. Well, they didn't sell that. Right? They might, a very frequent answer is, you know. Well, you know means it's good when I'm getting what I want, and it's not good when I'm not getting what I want. Same with up and down. Right? Same thing. Up and down means when I'm getting what I want, I'm happy, and when I'm not getting what I want, I'm not happy. So if a person says they're not in relationship, I say, how long has it been since you've been in relationship? And if they say 32 years since my divorce, if I say that must have been a hard divorce, if they say, oh no, I'm long over that, then that's like two different people talking to me. If you're over it, why haven't you been in a relationship for 32 years? Do you see? I may ask a person, have you ever been in a long-term relationship? And they may say yes. And I say, how long? They say 6 weeks. Well, that tells you about their value. You see, it's telling you about how they think about the world. 6 weeks, or they may say 6 months, right? Which to me would not be a long-term relationship. 6 months is like dating. It's not a long-term relationship. So I want to know about the quality of the relationship, and I want to know in what ways does it compare to how they talked about their parents and their siblings, and how they talked about their parents' relationship, if their parents were divorced or if the parents are still alive and married, for example. What are we, the circus? This must be the most interesting thing happening in Montreal this weekend. Okay, so tomorrow we should all, I'll wear a mask. I'll wear a Japanese kabuki mask.
But we all put it backwards.
Yes, exactly, and you all put it backwards. Exactly. Everyone bring a mask tomorrow to wear on the back of your head. Okay, so we've asked about the siblings, and we've asked about relationship. The biggest predictors in life, as I said, of health are birth family, the family you created, and job satisfaction. Those are the three, according to like all modern scientific research. Those are the big three factors that predict long health in life. Okay? So then I ask a person about their job. What do you do for a living? Ideally, a person's job gives them, would be a perfect opportunity to express the gifts and the capacities, the creative capacities that they bring to the world. But that's only true at our level of economic development and above, middle class and above. So I know this about all of you because everyone here could afford to spend $300 this weekend and come here just because you wanted to. So that means you're at a level of culture where the outcome of your life is more a result of the freely made choices that you have than any other human beings who've ever lived or are alive on the planet now. At lower levels of economic fortune, at lower levels of culture and lower levels of economic fortune, people just have to do the jobs they can do to survive. And they don't have the level of choice. But nobody made anyone in here become an acupuncturist. I had to become it. My father was an acupuncturist. I wanted to be an accountant, but my family forced me to go to acupuncture school. Right? So everyone in here has a job they chose, presumably because at a heart and soul level, they felt compelled to do it because they loved it. Right? So ideally, at our level, if somebody's paying you $50 a week or more for treatment, they're at a level of culture where their job should in some way be reflective of their capacities and be fulfilling in the way that I'm talking about. You understand? And if it isn't, you want to know why. If it isn't, you want to know why. And then you would want to, if it isn't, you want to know, as I said before, well, what would you rather do? If they can imagine something better, that's good. If they have plans and they're implementing it, short-term, medium, long-term plans, then that's good and hopeful. And if they don't have plans, then part of your practice has to be to help them get to a place where they can start imagining greater capacities for themselves. Human capacity, human potential is unlimited. Now, it may not be absolutely unlimited, but in comparison, but there are no limits we can conceive of on it. There are no limits we can conceive of on it. So if a person's 60 and they tell me they want to be an astronaut, that's not going to be very reasonable. But on the other hand, there really we have so many options and there's so many possibilities available today that I would think part of what we want to do to see as a person gets healthier is see them start to imagine greater and greater potentials for themselves and to embody capacities that they hadn't even been aware of in themselves, you see? Part of our job is to take people more seriously than they take themselves. Because most people have a very inherently limited sense of what's possible for them. You see? Not like damn the torpedoes, You know that phrase, damn the torpedoes? You ever hear that? I think it was a warship, an American warship captain in World War II. And they said there are submarines, and he had a mission. He said, damn the torpedoes, straight ahead. And they won some big battle. So damn the torpedoes. Tom Petty had an album called Damn the Torpedoes. I think his first album was called Damn the Torpedoes. And it just means regardless of what price we have to pay, we're doing it. It's like Gandhi getting the English out of India or Martin Luther King. Damn the torpedoes just means whatever, straight ahead. So damn the torpedoes, that is always the spirit. That is how spirit views your incarnation. The point of view of your spirit is we're going to go all the way or die trying. Do you see? And it has no inherent sense of limitation whatsoever about what's possible. So in relation, you didn't get to choose your birth family. You didn't get to choose your siblings. You chose your husband or wife, or boyfriend or girlfriend, as we say in Montreal, even if you're married and have 14 kids. I'm not married and have 14 kids, right? It's still my boyfriend and my girlfriend, apparently. Which sounds to me like you're 12-year-olds dating, but... Well, anyway, it's an American thing, maybe. So, so the thing is, even though you picked your partner, that the outcome of having a good relationship isn't entirely in your own hands, right? They could become an alcoholic. They could be abusive and you didn't know it. There could have been a fantastic 4 years and the person just withdrew for reasons that have nothing to do with you. It's just not personal, you see? And you have your kids and you can be the best, you can give birth to children and you can be the best parents in the world. And the kids can grow up to be rotten because of their own karmic issues that have nothing to do with you, right? It's out of your hands. They have their own destiny at some point, right? They have their own destiny. But the one thing you're in total control of that should only be positive is your hobby, right? So after going through birth family, your relationship, your siblings, your work, I ask, do you have a hobby? And a person's relationship to their hobby should only be 100% positive ever. If you say, what's your hobby? And the person goes, I build model trains. You gotta glue the wheels on and put them on the track. Why are you doing the damn thing? If it's so miserable. Your hobby should always be a source of enjoyment. Your hobby should be an ecstatically enjoyable because you chose, you would only have a hobby because you loved it. You see? So for me, it's like if we were flying to India together and you were on the plane next to me and you had Vintage Guitar magazine and I saw you took it out, I would be like, wow. And we could just talk about guitars for 14 hours and we would get to Delhi and I'd be like, where did the time go? Do you see? We'd exchange phone numbers and then every time we ever talked, it would be like guitars, guitars, guitars. I have one friend that I ran with when I was doing long distance running. I ran with him for 15 years, 2 to 4 hours a week. And the only thing we ever talked about was guitars. And it was never changed, and it was always new. So that's one of the attributes of spirit, is when spirit is involved with something, when you meditate, it never changes, and it's always new, you see? When spirit is involved, the quality of spirit is always the same, always new. Always the same, always new. Totally compelling, even though it's never different, do you see?
Hobby and job are, one and the same. We see a lot of people in our field like that, right? That's what lights people up, is talking about Chinese medicine and being involved in it, or Qigong or whatnot.
Well, if it's healthy, that's good. But something like Chinese medicine is more serious than a hobby. So my hobby is guitar, and I love guitar, and generally when I can, I play an hour a day. But Chinese medicine is 24 hours a day, and has been since I was a kid. So it's just, there's just a difference. Do you see? Yeah. I mean, this is what I'm giving, you know, this is what I'm giving my life to. Yeah. So when a person's talking about their hobby, there should be joy. That should be the prime time, that there should be no reason in the world Shen shouldn't be coming through their eyes. And if a person's talking about their hobby as if it's a burden, that's earth. Earth. Because earth just turns everything into burden, right? Fat. Damp. It just turns everything that should have become blood to nourish it, instead becomes just weight to carry around. You see? So you want to look for the Shen coming through the eyes. If a person's depressed when they're talking about their hobby, their diagnosis is relatively more serious. If the person is down when they're talking about their mother, their father, their sister, their brother, their lover, their kids, there's room for that in life, because all of that has a very significant component that's out of your hands. But when you're talking about your hobby, for everyone, they should just light up. Do you see? You see what I'm saying? And if a person doesn't, if they don't have a hobby, that's not good. That's not good. And if they're talking about it and there's no joy coming through, then the condition is serious. It's deep. The sadness, the depression, the loss, whatever's behind it's very deep. But if they can come out of that depth and talk about something they love quickly with fire in their eyes, which would presumably be their hobby, that's a good prognosis, because they have at least one area of their life where there's joy. If there's no area of their life where there's joy, that's relatively deeper and more serious. So now we're done, we've gotten a background. This is sort of the broad foundation of a person's life. And now we get to, why are you here? And I ask people, in order, I want you to tell me what your goals are, why you're here, what are your goals for treatment, and tell me what you hope to have accomplish in order of importance to you. In order of importance. And some people will say, they'll list six things, but I want to go through them one at a time. So I'll say, okay, which one of those is most important? And they'll say, high blood pressure. They'll say headaches, whatever it is. And then I want to know about whatever they say. How long have you had it? What have you done for it? What has worked? What hasn't worked? What's the biomedical diagnosis? Is it the same, getting better, or getting worse than it's been? I want to know, where are they in the progression? Are they just at a plateau and it's been where it is now has been where it's been for 15 years? Or all of a sudden it's gotten much worse? Or all of a sudden it's a little better? And being better is a possibility, because very often when people come to us, going to an acupuncturist or herbalist is just one thing they're doing. And they're in a path of healing that they may have been engaged on for a while. So it may actually be better to a point. So I want to know that. I want to know, is it better or worse at a time of day, which I'm correlating with the Chinese clock? Is it better or worse in a certain kind of weather? If it gets worse in cold, damp weather, I'm always very happy to hear that, because there's an herb formula I can give that'll make it instantly better. Is it worse in high or low pressure systems? So is it worse when it's just about to storm? If it's worse when it's just, if they have headaches and it's worse when it's just about to storm, that's great, because there's one herb formula you give and it'll clear it up, even if they've had it for 25 years. With a woman, is it better or worse at any point in the menstrual cycle? If it gets worse as they're leading up to their menstrual cycle, then it's a symptom of excess. You all understand, right? And if it gets worse when they start bleeding, then it's a symptom of deficiency. Okay? I want to know, is it better when you get up in the morning or worse when you get up in the morning? If it's better when they get up in the morning, then I know that it's movement related, and that when everything slows down and the chi stops moving, then they feel better. If it's worse when they get up in the morning, I know it's circulatory related, because when the circulation slows overnight, the pain gets worse. But as soon as they start moving during the day, going about the day, the heart is pumping harder, the metabolism raises, the blood circulation improves, especially into the periphery, into the microcapillaries, because the heart is working harder to push it there. And then we will have just about covered it. And when we get through, these are all questions you were probably taught to ask. Then I say, what's the next thing? And we go through all the same questions. What's the next thing? And we go through all the same questions. What's the next thing? And then eventually at some point they'll say, that's it. And then we're done with that part of the exam. But then I've heard out all their issues. If a person has one or two issues, that's average. And by the time we get to six or eight issues, the prognosis is going to be worse. And the condition is obviously much more serious, more long-term, and they're likely to be on many more medications, which we'll be asking about in a few minutes. But obviously, the more they have, the more individual things that are going on, the more systems and the more organs and are related, and the more deeply rooted the illness is going to be. So then after we've gone through that, we start going through systems. And I ask the person, how is your overall energy? If the person says, it's okay. I don't just write down okay, right? If the person says, I have enough to get through and do whatever I need to do, I say, okay, they just know how to use their will, but their energy is not good. If the person says, I am exhausted, then I know similarly there's a sort of disconnect. And I always will ask a person, I want you to rate your energy on a scale of 1 to 10. And I always, before I ask that question, have guessed what I think it is according to how they're being. Do you see? So if I told you my energy is on average daily a 2 out of 10, that would be weird, wouldn't it? Right? If I told you like 8, 9 out of 10, would that work? That would work, right? That'd be about right. So I want to see what's the person's self-image compared to how I would actually rate them. And when a person is picking a number close to what I'd pick, then I go, this is a good sign because it shows they're actually in touch with what their actual condition is. And the worst diagnosis is always out of touch with what the actual condition is. Because that means that to the degree they're out of touch across multiple kinds of assessment, it means that they're unconsciously motivated. It's just a machine running things. They're not paying attention to their inner life, which means they're not caring for themselves appropriately, etc. So if they say that their energy is a 2, a 4, a 6, a 7 out of 10, I'll ask, well, when was the last time it was really a 9 or 10 out of 10? And if they say 2 weeks ago, or even 6 months ago, or even a year ago, that's hopeful. But if they say, I've never had good energy, or if they say, geez, 15, 20 years ago, then you know it's more deep, it's more long-standing, and your expectation is this is going to take longer to make real progress with, which will help me give feedback to them at the end of the session about what my expectations are for improvement. So then I ask about sleep. An average adult needs 6 to 8 hours sleep a night. 6 to 8 hours sleep a night. At one end of the bell-shaped curve is 6. In my experience, most people getting less than 6 hours of sleep a night on a consistent basis are going to become ill. It's just not enough. On the other hand, most people who need substantially more than 8 also have something wrong with them. As you get older, it's natural to need less sleep, and it's probably not healthy for somebody approaching 60 to need 8 hours sleep a night. It's too yin for the kidney, that much sleep. It's fine if a 60-year-old is sleeping 6 to 7 hours a night, that's all right. If a teenager is only getting 6 hours a night, they're still growing and the body really needs time to rest and recoup because so much metabolic resource is going into growing bone and everything, they need downtime. Do you see?
More. You're saying because the experience is so much more young, but it gets less young as we get older, so you need less yin to need it.
Well, I wasn't putting it exactly that way, but that makes sense. That makes sense. But look, a kid, my son, you know, he's grown 2 inches a year the last 4 years. That takes energy. He needs rest. He's 15 years old. He's grown half an inch in the last 2 months. So you need downtime to do that. But if an 80-year-old sleep in 5-6 hours a night, that's okay. If they need 9-10 hours a night, that's too yin for them. It's better to have less.
I guess that's the part I don't totally understand. What do you mean it's too yin for them?
For the kidney, you want the kidney to have exercise more young. Not to be in a sleep mode. Yeah.
As you get older.
Well, it's natural. That's why elderly people have a harder time sleeping, but that's natural. So just as they grow older, you have them take a half-hour nap every day between 11 to 2, or a 45-minute nap, even an hour. That's okay. But it's all right to be up at night. If a 75-year-old comes to me and says, I have insomnia, I go to bed at 10 and I wake up at 3 or 4, it doesn't concern me that much. I just tell them take a 45-minute nap in the middle of every day. They'll be getting the sleep they need. If you have an 85-year-old who comes to you and their left proximal pulse is deep and feeble, oh my God, you're Jing deficient. Well, they're 90 years old.
Yeah.
It's all right. Here, eat these lycee berries. I mean, but if you get a 12-year-old whose left proximal pulse is deficient, how are they going to make it another 70 years? You see? Okay, so ask about sleep. When sleep is disturbed, it's always a sign of the spirit not resting in the heart. If people's primary complaint is insomnia, first of all, people have to want to sleep. And a lot of people don't want to sleep. What I do is I work hard, and when I get in bed, I'm just ready to die. I'm ready to let it all go. A lot of people won't let it go because they're actually afraid of death, because sleep is death. Where are you in your deepest sleep? Do you exist in your deepest sleep? I'm not talking about when you're dreaming. I'm talking about your deepest sleep. There's nothing, right? Yeah, so people don't want to let go into that. So I have found that the best thing for insomnia is teaching people to meditate and really let go in meditation. So if you can really let go in meditation, then you can get to a point where you can just let go at night, and letting go into sleep is the same as letting go into meditation. These days, you know, a lot of people don't let themselves get the sleep they need, especially younger people. And that's when they need the sleep more, actually. You don't need it as much when you're older. So ask about sleep, ask about energy, ask about circulation. So circulation to me means, are you excessively warm or excessively cold? And if a person says cold, I want to know, is it just your hands and feet cold, which would be counterflow qi, which means qi stagnation in the diaphragm, most likely, implicates qi stagnation in the diaphragm. Is it just hands and feet cold, or is your whole body cold, which is more of a kidney yang deficiency? ultimately a fire deficiency. I want to know if a person has Raynaud's symptom. Do you know what Raynaud's is? When the fingertips go blue and purple? There's a formula that just takes care of that like this. So if they say they're cold, and I think they're the type, I'll look at them and say, well, do your fingertips ever turn white or blue or purple? And if they say yes, there's an herb formula, Danque Sinisan, that you give, and it'll help, you know, 90% of them, boom, like this. Yes, Raynaud's syndrome.
What's the name of it?
Danque C-S-I Ni N-I San S-A-N Danque Sinisan. Treats counterflow liver stagnation and tonifies blood.
Would that still be good for the when it's stuck in the diaphragm and then
Reach them? Yeah, but you do acupuncture like liver 13 and 14, pericardium 6, CV15 to open the diaphragm.
Is it only good for renal or
It's particularly good for people, mostly women, with very thin pulses bilaterally. So the pulse feels this thin on both sides when their fingertips turn white or blue. And you give them this formula and boom, makes it go away in like 3 days. Works very, very well. Sometimes a person can have it their whole life. You have them take 2 bottles of this, like 1 month worth. And it's gone forever. Works really well. One bottle can make it go away, 1 or 2 bottles, even if they had it their whole life.
Okay. What if it's stirred on by cold? Is it just the cold creating the stagnation? Or
if it's not the Raynaud's?
Well, I get it in my hands and feet.
Right.
Just so when it's really cold.
Yeah, right. So some people have it so they it could be the middle of August and they open the refrigerator and take a bottle of a drink, a cold drink out, and just touching that, all the cold will go out. So the cold brings it on, but that's because all the person's warmth is retreating into the interior. And this will help fill out the interior. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
Danque Sinisan, S-I-N-I-S-A-N. Okay, so sleep, energy, circulation, then ask about appetite. How's your appetite? Of course, it's a very concerning thing if a person has lost their appetite recently, or if they have no appetite chronically, that's concerning. And if they've just recently lost it, it's very concerning because one of the signs, for instance, of cancer or very serious illnesses would be a rapid onset loss of appetite. Some people will say, oh, well, too good. That's a normal, too good. And then that leads you to a very sort of earth and overindulgent materialism. Assessment of materialism and looking to satisfy themselves through their appetite. It's talking to an ambivalence in relationship to nourishment and poor boundary around what's the difference between what I want and what I need. And that those two things aren't blurred in their minds and often they're in conflict. Should I have one? How many should I have? How many should I save? Can I have one more? If I don't have one more, how victimized am I going to be about it? How, do I need to give in to every desire I have? You see? I want to know what they crave. And the cravings are all just the 5-element flavors, right? So obviously you have salty and sour and bitter, sweet and pungent. So what do they crave or what do they avoid? I want to know that because of the 5-element association. Some people will say, if you say, there'll be some people who everything about them tells you that they should be craving sweets. And you'll ask them, do you crave sweets? And they'll say no. And the reason they don't crave them is they have so many of them that it never gets to the point of craving. No, well, it's true. Well, you're not going to, if you're eating 16 ounces of chocolate a day, you're not going to crave chocolate because you're just eating it continually. Do you see? So you just have to follow up on that. I want to know what allergies a person has. Allergies are important. If a person has allergies to nuts, you have to be careful about the Chinese herbs you're giving them if those herbs contain nuts or seeds. So like Xuanzaoren, well, Xuanzaoren, right, is a seed. And if a person even has a peanut allergy or something, they can have a cross allergy to something else. So you have to be very careful if they're allergic to nuts or seeds, for instance, and know what's in the herbs that you're giving them. I asked them about digestion. Digestion to me means, do you get stomach aches? Do you get bloating? Do you have acid reflux? Well, if the answer is yes to any of those, Chinese medicine can obviously take care of it like that if the person will do what we tell them to do. Acupuncture and herbs work fantastic, and dietary change. But if a person, you have to determine then what the source of it is. And for many people eat too fast because they're just multitasking and they're running from one thing to the next. And they're just eating and checking mail on their phone and working on the computer and watching a television show. Too much simultaneous input at the same time. So if people are eating too fast, when you chew your food, you're breaking it down and you're putting saliva into it, which is a digestive enzyme that begins the process of breaking it down. If you eat too fast, you're not chewing and the big chunks of food go into your stomach. And then your stomach has to generate more heat to break the food down. And then over time, that heat is going to cause stomach yin deficiency. And the kidney will supply yin, and then the kidney will become yin deficient. And then you get all these yang ming syndrome patterns, anything from diabetes, gingivitis, bleeding gums, constant cold sores in the mouth with red tip of the tongue, even nosebleeds with heat and fire rising in the yang ming channels. And all that can be traced to decades of eating too quickly. So people need to eat slower. I want to know about bowel movements. Everyone should have one bowel movement a day. That should be at least 1 to 2 bowel movements a day, and they should be formed. They can be, if it's a little loose, that's okay. But nobody should have diarrhea. If a person's missing 1 day a week or 1 day every 2 weeks even, where they don't go to the bathroom, that's pathological. There should be a bowel movement at least every day, and it should be formed. A lot of people have bowel movements that go back and forth between constipation and diarrhea. And a lot of that has to do with too much gluten, too much wheat in the diet. If it is wheat, I can always tell on a person's pulse. So I just feel the small intestine pulse, and I can always tell if it's if they need to go off gluten from that. But the average diet in North America is just way too much white food. Just way too much salt, way too much sugar, way too much bread, pasta, rice, potatoes. It's just huge in the diet. And then with people on gluten-free diets, a lot of that gluten-free stuff isn't so great to have in large quantities too, because it's just tons of rice or tapioca. It's just tons of grains, right?
Do you think of gluten as a deficiency in the small intestine?
Well, it's not that it's a deficiency. What the gluten actually does is bind the small intestine up, so it has to overwork, and that creates heat and inflammation. So it actually turns into, it's an excess condition that over time can consume fluids because of the fire and then result in yin deficiency.
And do you think that's a problem for us as opposed to the history of the Chinese, because the gluten's different now and we eat so much of it?
Yeah, because it's refined and genetically modified. And we're also, a different people. I don't really have the answer.
Yeah.
I don't really have the answer to why. Because people in Asia obviously lived for a long time just eating rice.
Yeah.
I mean, the average Asian, what did they eat? They ate rice. Right? So, okay, then I want to know about urination. How many times a day? On average, women should go a bit more than men. So a woman, 10, 12 times a day, and an average, yeah. What, no? Too much? Well, let's vote. How many women in here go about 10 times a day?
It depends if you're drinking enough or not.
Yeah, depends if you're hydrated. Well, that was a fair amount of women. Okay, so anyway, women, if they need to go, put it this way, 10 times a day for a guy would be really a lot. Even if I drink, you see, I've been drinking the whole time I'm here. I drink 2 to 3 liters a day, but I only go about 6 times a day, eight at the most. But, and if a woman told me she went 8, that's fine. But if a woman says she goes 12 times a day, women are yin. They just have more fluid, more damp to get rid of, and that's fine. If a woman's going 16, 20 times a day, that's a lot. But 12 times a day, I wouldn't think of it for a woman. Don't you notice when you go to movies and theaters and concerts that the line at the women's bathroom is always much, much longer than the line at the men's bathroom, right?
Sometimes I think it's a
mirror check,
too.
I don't know. Anyway, so then, okay, so with women, break?
Yeah.
Okay, break.